Welcome back to Deep Thoughts, ladies and gentlemen. So finally got my haircut. Everyone was like, I love your haircut. I was like, man, it's still down in my ass. Like, how could it possibly be cut? I have not recorded a show in probably 4 weeks. One, the weather here has been atrocious. It's actually great because it's been raining like crazy, but just haven't been able to get out. It's been really cold. And so today is a miraculous day of 74 degrees. It's actually cooled off just a tad, but definitely able to get out here. Still have even more shows in the queue. I'm certainly taking time on this moon one. Not the one called the moon, but the moon evidence hoax video. Not sure what to call that really long episode. The beautiful bush that's in the intro has been neglected by my gardening guys, and it fell over, and so it's about 2 feet from me right now, so I got to get that fixed too. Now, today's episode, I'm calling today's episode State of Mind, and I'm not exactly sure at all what I'm going to exactly talk about, but I have a goal, and my goal is to make sure that we understand that at all times we have a state of mind. And that might sound real trivial, like all introductions to simple concepts that go deep and go wide. But I beg you to hang in there, because I think that very quickly you will realize this is true. And this is something you don't think about very often, but it absolutely positively controls your destiny. It controls how you think about everything that's possible and how you engage your life minute to minute, second to second. Now, I want you to think about, very quickly here, anytime you've ever felt like, geez, something is not quite right with the way I think, either you don't have enough confidence or you're trying to change a habit, maybe you eat too much food, think about sex too much, whatever it is, you're like, damn, I wish I had more control over that. And then you go to a bookstore, you go online, and you start searching for things. Perhaps even you have a good friend you can rely on, you talk to them. And you have a discussion, you read about something, and then in the end, what you find out is that the only thing that's trying to happen here is that whatever you're engaging is just trying to change your state of mind. The book is trying to change your state of mind. The website's trying to change your state. A YouTube channel, someone talking to you, you thinking in a vacuum by yourself. That's what you're trying to do, right? If you have confidence issues, and I don't necessarily mean you look in the mirror and that sort of confidence issue. That's a whole category of confidence. It could just be you're about to engage in a sport. You're about to do one particular event where you need to have your courage. You're going to go into a big important meeting. You're going to ask a girl or maybe a guy to marry you, and you just need it at that moment just to get over the hump. And so what you do is you start searching in the back of your mind for all those moments in your life when you had the courage, either because you felt like you had earned the courage, or it was just there and you were too naive to know that it shouldn't be there. And that's a tongue-in-cheek statement. You should always have your confidence and screw anybody else. I met one of my listeners. She came to visit me right here on this patio. And she said something really interesting to me. And it's really had an impression on me. It's very strange. She said, she was talking about my confidence. And she said, well, you're just a freak of nature when it comes to confidence. And I looked at her, you know, I was like, whoa, that's something I have never heard those statements put together in one sentence, where it was confidence and freak of nature all in one sentence. And what that did for me was it reminded me for a split second that, at least in her perception, I have an incredible level of self-confidence. I think it's true. I do. I wouldn't say I have in every single category of life, you know, and it comes and it goes, right? You have strong days and weak days or whatever. I think that let's just take a break on confidence as a state of mind for 1 second, because it seems to be something that, you know, really determines whether or not we as human beings have successful lives or not. I think one of the greatest gifts you can have when you're young, it's probably twofold, but one, having parental units around you that make you feel invincible, and two, carrying that gift from your parents or your guardians into a realm where you're too dumb to know that maybe you should have been a little more cautious. And the basis of this is you should have confidence. Screw everybody else. You know, it's kind of like getting credit before you have credit. We're going to have confidence and test that stuff out before you actually realize you have real confidence because you've actually accomplished it. There's a statement out there that I should know the gentleman who coined it, but there's nothing to fear but fear itself, right? Back when I used to do audio essays, I did one on fear, and I should probably do it again. But just a little caveat is there's that whole chicken and egg thing about who you are as an individual. And we tend to randomly live our lives and randomly try things and have a good time with life. And then at some point, there's a state of mind flip, a consciousness flip, where all of a sudden we can view ourselves almost out of body. And it's a very dangerous thing when you start doing that, because maybe you dig what you see, maybe you don't. Maybe you dig 90% of it, but not 10% of it. Hell, maybe you like 99% of it, but not 1% of it. And it's that ability to abstract yourself out of your body that will potentially threaten your overall image. Now, we all know as adults, if you've just heard me say that, that some people need to get the hell out of their body for a couple seconds to take a look, right? They're annoying. They can't see what they look like. They think that they're looking a lot different than they do. I've said in several episodes, you know, having employed several technical people in my lifetime, otherwise known as nerds, you know, I've got nerd inside, you know, but I try not to exude it on the outside. But these beautiful, amazing people who literally, if you were in the apocalypse, the closest you can get to a nerd clan, the better and safer you'll be. But a nerd doesn't know that they have a body half the time. And they never do go outside their body to look in. They stay very focused internally. And the interesting thing is they'll pick the weirdest clothing. If they realize they have hair on their head, their choice of how to arrange it's usually fairly functional and not fashion-based, and that's fine. But I'll look at them every once in a while, and I just want to, you know, just put my hand through their hair. Let's just get that to lie down a little bit more, their alfalfa. You know, I just want to do a little digression here for a second. I grew up with the Little Rascals, and I don't know that any kids do grow up with the Little Rascals. And I'll tell you what, there are some amazing, beautiful, uptick moral messages in the Little Rascals. If you got kids, pull out those old 1920s, 1930s cartoons. I guess they're in the 40s as well, but I think it's mainly during the Depression. And show them those. Yeah, there's a few racist things here and there, but, you know, they do a pretty good job balancing everything out in the end. But now let's talk about the state of mind. Let's take control over this serendipitous thing that we've been playing with our whole lives, right? The state of mind is essentially, it's a bit like a computer processor. You know, when you get your computer in a box and it's just sitting there powerless inside the box, the CPU, the central processing unit, and its memory inside the processing unit, not the memory that goes with your computer. That's separate. And don't get that confused with the storage, which is the disk drive of some sort. But the CPU is just off. Nothing in there. And you know that when you unpack your computer, and let's say your neighbor got a computer on the same day, or your wife, or your spouse, or your kid, or whatever, you pull them out of the box, you put them all together, and you power it up. And you start moving your files and your applications on this thing. And you start double-clicking. And your friend will do exactly the same thing. That you're automatically putting your computers in different states right away. And that might sound like a crazy analogy, but think about it. This is how you and other human beings build your brains. Now, on this show, I've taken from the Hindu teachings where I believe you do have a soul, a body, and a mind. Your soul's what you really are, and that's the part you traverse the universe with infinitely. Your body is this particular instance where you've used the soil and the nutrients from the ground and your mother and your father, and you've built the body that you have. And your mind happens to be the intersection point between those two. When you have brought in a state of consciousness, you bring in some wisdom from your soul, and you bring in some current state properties of this universe into the cavity that is the brain. I don't think the brain does much, to be honest with you. And I know you can open brains up and poke on them. Believe me, I've read all Kurzweil's books. But I really think that it's an illusion. I think it is an electrical conduit between your soul and your body. It just happens to be up there. And I do believe organs heavily control how much access you do have to your soul. And I think it's a big deal when we do talk about your state of mind. The more healthy your brain is, which is going to require healthy water, toothpaste without fluoride, water without fluoride, food without GMOs, all that good stuff. As much as you can cleanse yourself, no microwave ovens, all this good stuff, no cell phones next to your heads. It's going to control how well the data goes back and forth. It's just like a computer. Would you ever do anything to make the CPU in your computer slower? You know, would you take little rust, you know, spices and sprinkle it all inside your machine and hopefully it, you know, doesn't hurt your computer? No. So we have to get the body cleansed so we can access our mind, which is a temporary state. Because this show is called State of Mind, so we're going to have to work with the mechanics. You know, you've got, I was trying to think of a good analogy. Take a drag race car, top fuel driver. A top fuel driver is made of at least three different things, very similar to body, soul, and mind. The soul of a drag race team are the mechanics who understand all of the physics and mechanical properties of a combustion engine at that super top fuel level. They understand in their brain, every time they come to a drag race team, they can build an engine any way they want with gigantic pipes, with gigantic cylinders, really super long chassis, super grip tires. I mean, in their brain, there are no limits as to what they can do. You know, if you gave them $1 billion, they could build a car the size of a house that would go 1,000 miles an hour. I mean, they just can do that. So that's your soul of the team, because it's all theoretical and infinite in its potential. But in the end, they do have to build a car. And so in the end, you get a car, the body, the thing that is the instantiated instance of their concepts and their mathematical models and their experience. And I'm sure that the body that we use today is a result of the brainiacs of the universe testing stuff out. Then you have your driver. And what does the driver do? Well, the driver knows the soul. The driver knows the body. But the driver's main job is to live in the moment, to understand the body that they are sitting inside of, and to understand the physics of the soul. And based on the track, based on who they're driving up against, they take that temporary moment and they haul ass down a runway. And that's us. So, how do we apply that and pull that back to our existence today? Well, we have some amazing listeners, and I've had the privilege of chatting with several of them. And I will say that the listeners that I'm most impressed with, that teach me without really trying to teach me, are the ones that really get into the metaphysics of humanity. And I don't agree with every single thing they come up with. Some of them live in horoscopes. They really dive into astrology and numerology. For me, I've been down those tracks, and for me, they don't really apply much to my existence, I own my existence personally, right? I will never wake up in the morning and read someone else's random interpretation of my life and let them control me. This is all manifest destiny. This is all law of attraction. So the second you pick up a news article and read your horoscope, regardless of how accurate it has ever been in the past, you are drawing that frequency to yourself, and it could either be great or it could not be great. I suppose if you read horoscopes every day that told you that everything's going to be wonderful, maybe that works. You know, as Prince said in Under the Cherry Moon when talking about tarot cards, he said, I think you just tell people what they want to hear, and it happens. All right. And for me, it's not about being weak to a law of attraction. It's actually, it's one of these things of why would you build up a skill in doing something that you would never really want to do in real life, which is not control every split second of your existence. And I'll give you an example. I would imagine that most of you who watch this show are into truth, with a capital T. And you understand that, you know, you won't always understand what the truth is, but you're striving for it every single day. And external truth, internal truth, meaning the truth of who you are and who you can be and the truth of the universe and who other people are and how you interact, both from a psychological level and a sociological level, you're trying. And I think that that's a muscle you want to build. And so you don't lie. You don't lie because you don't want that skill. Now, what I found in my brief experimentation with lying, especially watching society be duped by liars, you can always lie to someone who is not as smart as you. It's almost effortless. If someone isn't as smart as you, boy, you can tell them anything. And that is why I think that there's a direct correlation between leadership of a country, leadership of a company, and its employees. There's some leaders who really, really, really care or have cared about their employees and their intelligence levels, right? Steve Jobs, for instance, really coined the phrase of hiring A players, basically. Hiring people who are as intelligent or more intelligent than he is after vetting their goals and their obedience to the goals of the company. And so while he was the CEO, magic always happened at Apple. And just look at what happened when Tim Cook took over. Tim Cook is a D player who hires F players, and he has just destroyed the company. And apparently the board of directors at Apple are also a bunch of F plus players because they're unable to get rid of this guy. They're unable to see how horrible the company has run since then, right? So we want to, in our own world, be our own A player. And I want to take a second to say, you know, this is about the state of mind. What I want to make sure that doesn't happen as a result of this episode is that you wake up and you're almost self-conscious about every second of your life because you're thinking about that state of mind. What state of mind am I in? What state of mind am I in? That can get to the point where everything gets a little too meticulous. Perhaps you might feel like you have to control reality because you're really, you know, you're determining the petals falling off a rose or something. Or whether or not it's going to rain outside, right? With everything in life, there are course paths that you take. And there are fine-tuning paths that you take, right? So sometimes you're going to paint a house with a sprayer. It's going to knock out a 6-foot wide color. And other times you're going to paint with a single hair off the tail of a camel. Because you're trying to paint the most meticulous thing in life. Putting a dot of color on a canvas, right? And you should know at any one point in time sort of where you are in that game. And you'll go through phases, of course. Again, if you wake up in your life and you're like, geez, you know, I feel deep down inside that I know what I want. As a general overall feeling, I'm not quite sure what job that means. I'm not sure, you know, which spouse that means or how I'm going to, you know, you're not sure what the picks are, but you feel it. You feel it inside yourself. You probably are in a more coarse brush approach. And you need to start putting yourself in positions, aka states of mind, that'll start to experiment with what those things could be. And I'll give you a really good example of one that's sort of one we don't like to think about, but it's sort of really fun at the same time. If you're a very sociable person, you might serendipitously grow up in a really good small community. You didn't have to move that much from where you graduated high school, and you just got a good collection of friends. And for a decade, those friends are hanging out. They're always easy to find. In fact, sometimes there's just too many of them, and you're always playing the game of trying to make sure that one doesn't feel neglected over the other. Try to bring some of them together if you can. But around 28 to 32, a bunch of them start getting married. They've picked a partner out of the world. Sometimes you can always see them. I've got neighbors that hang out, two times a month at least, sometimes four or five times a month, and they're all their high school friends here from Orange County, California, and they just have a great time, and they've known each other forever, and they tell me stories about how long they've known each other. It's really cool. But I know that in my own travels, I personally will go in and out of collections of friends based on where I live. I've been pretty lucky to live in the same place for over a decade, so I'm taken care of now, but there's two types of companionship. And this is just an example of other states of mind you can compare this to. And I'll get into finding a job here in a second. But sometimes you want a companion that's much closer. Someone you see every single day. Someone perhaps you live with. You want to sleep next to them at night. You want to share all those rituals in the morning, an afternoon and evening. You want to call each other during the day and text each other during the day. You want a relationship. Much closer than a friendship. But you may not have an immediate circle that's going to provide choices, right? You may have a great circle of friends, but you know, those are all the same sex as you are, and you're attracted to the opposite sex or vice versa. And here's the weird thing. In this day and age, with all the social media and all these virtual friends that we have online, I think that we have run the risk of losing the art of finding human beings in the real world. Now, this relates to state of mind because this is going to be an example of a very important shift in the state of mind that will get you to go out there and find those people. Now, one of the things that, again, we don't talk about this kind of stuff, and it's not that like anyone's trying to hide it. It's just, I think part of it has to do with our egos in the process, is that when you find the fact, when you realize that you really want a companion in life, and you start looking at your life and you're going, gosh, do I even have an artery to meet anyone that would be the kind of person I'd want to be with? You can go through various states of mind. Usually one of the very first ones is a bit of insecurity. Oh my God. I don't really have a circle of friends or a gym or whatever, some common gathering where I can meet people that would be candidates, right? So that can be a little alarming. But now I've tried to help folks several times on the various shows, and especially in season one, where I talk about the fact that we all know there's a lot of fish in the sea. And for whatever ridiculous reason, if you find yourself without a companion and you want one, a lot of times we actually believe that we have dated a huge selection of people in our local area or whatever. And when you really start doing some math, you realize that you have barely interacted with society. You have barely met anyone your whole life. If you want to know the percentages, you total up a number of all the people you think you've met your whole life. And then you divide it by the world population. And you move the decimal places two to the right, and that's your percentage. And I'm willing to bet there's a lot of zeros before that decimal, or after that decimal place. You barely met anyone your whole life. Now, sometimes it can be, it's an interesting double-edged sword, right? On one side, you think you found your soulmate. Well, you've barely met anyone in the entire world, so I think that's sort of funny. But two, you might find that you feel your state of mind gets a little desperate and you think, well, I'm never going to find the right person. You know, if I was going to meet the right person, I would have met them already. totally untrue, right? But it's a state of mind that makes you believe that for any 1 second of the day. And obviously, you shouldn't have that state of mind. That should never cross your mind. Now, obviously, what we need to do is find ourselves a little bit of a circle. Get out there and meet people. Try to be genuine to the circles that you're traveling in, right? If you go hang out at bars to find someone and you find a bar fly, well, you may not live at the bar, but they do. You need to know those things. If you're not really a gym goer, but you go to a gym, you better fall in love with the gym if they're a gym person, because you don't want to bait and switch them. I only went to the gym to meet people. Once I met you, I stopped going to the gym and I started eating pie every day. I've talked about the job thing because it's a real... There's all kinds of states of mind that manage your quality of having a job, right? Part of it is that you love your job and you want to keep it. And so part of it is to wake up every day with the confidence to have that state of mind to perform well at your job. Yeah, I've got a whole episode on how to get a job. And I know that's not very appealing to folks, but if you feel trapped in the job that you're in, or you don't have a job and you need a job, I assure you there's lessons in there that will help you out and change your state of mind. But one of the biggest states of mind that I had run into in my 20s that had to be changed was that I would be working at a company who was, you know, usually okay. But I wanted another job. And like, I got into the video game industry drawing video games for a couple years, then popped out, did corporate stuff, which was really, really fun. But then when I moved right next door to Electronic Arts up in the Bay Area, it was about a 3-year period where I was out of the video game industry in corporate America doing stuff, and I finally found the opportunity to get back in. And so I'm sitting here fully aware that I'm a video game coder, I'm a video game artist, I'm a pretty damn good designer. I love the process of making games. But here I am working at this database company. But I'm one of the best database programmers on planet Earth for this particular language that I was programming in, because I work for the company that made the language. So I was able to be an expert. But I had to overcome this state of mind that I had lost the opportunity, you know, forever. That somehow I would take my resume into this company, a very young guy, very hungry, very accomplished. I'd already sold a video game. I sold a video game at like 19 years old. And, you know, not a lot of employees moving into Electronic Arts had done that before 20, right? And for those of you curious, the game I made was called Mutant Warriors, and it was rebranded as a game called Ray Tracer, or Ray Trace. The company that bought it was Mastertronics. I'm not sure they ever released it in America, so we're not sure. They gave us money, so that was good. I'll tell you this much, though. The game Fallout from the early 90s, 2 years later, used a lot of my game design. A lot of the stuff that people loved about it. But I remember the day that I was sitting in this office. I was probably anywhere from 21 to 23, somewhere in there. And I remember thinking, gosh, I have to convince myself that I can be hired by this other company. And I sat there for days just thinking and looking out this window, which I think at this point was on a parking lot in Foster City, California. But my biggest problem, after I finally gained the confidence to believe that I could do it, was that I wasn't very good at pitching myself, because I really felt like being boastful was just not my gig. It's very tough. I even struggle with it to this day. And then what's funny is you'll get around people who are very boastful about their pasts, or they embellish their pasts. I have friends of mine that... by God, if they've touched your project, they have done your whole project in terms of recalling it to other people, right? Which is sort of funny. Really sort of funny. I've got people that say they've done things that they have never done in their entire lifetime. And it's part of it's their ego, and part of it's the sheer ignorance of them not understanding what they're talking about and saying that they've done things that they haven't done. It's really interesting. It's tantamount to, you know, picking the paint job on a drag race car, and then for the rest of their life saying to the rest of the world that they built drag race cars. They understand everything about drag race cars because they figured out how to put a red stripe on one or a decal on the front. It's really funny. It's really kind of sad sometimes. But here's the thing about states of mind that are super duper important. Now that we're at the halfway mark. We have the ability to read each other's minds quite accurately. And I know a lot of you listening know this. And if you know this, please take a moment to pat yourself on the back. And I almost mean that literally, because we feel frequencies from each other big time. We feel the genuine frequency. You know, I think a lot of listeners who have commented on my videos, you guys get me. You do. And I think that you understand that I'm a very genuine person and this is who I am. And for the few of you who have actually physically met me in the real world, you know that I'm this person. There's no hidden agenda. I'm not some weirdo when I turn off the camera. And I suggest, hopefully, that if you find yourself kind of being a little two-faced, and it could be for the better, you know, it's what I want to say, you're not two-faced in a Marvel comic or DC comic two-face way. You're in a, perhaps it's just a brighter disposition you give the outer public. You know, a little more of a bubbly spirit. You'll see this a lot in soccer moms. Females are really, really good at this. Men, we have our own little techniques. My dad was always and is still an extremely good, I don't even know what you call it, like a chameleon for older people. Now, he is the older person, but when I was young and he was in his 30s, early 40s, we used to do a lot of services for the older people in my hometown. And, you know, they're very scared of technology. They're scared of having their money stolen. You know, we used to detail cars and fix electronics and just do all kinds of stuff. And so my father would go in there and really just put on a voice that just made them feel wonderful. And he is a genuine guy. And so he always delivered. We always delivered everything that we said and absolutely did not charge that much money for anything that we did. And we built a reputation. And as part of our surname in the town, that we are a trustworthy family. And you just come to us for anything. And if we say we can, we can. And if we can't, we don't charge any money, you know. But what's real important is you understand what Sigmund Freud was talking about, because he gets at this this exact thing I'm talking about, which I believe is driven by a state of mind, both subconsciously and consciously. So Freud said that there's three pieces to your personality, or to your person, I should say. You have your outer persona that you give pretty much new acquaintances, not your closest family members, hopefully. And then you have your character, which is who you really are. And this is what your family usually sees because they're with you constantly. And there's no way you can keep a persona going. There's a lot of energy being consumed by a persona. And it's sort of, you know, it's that voice where you, you know, if you hold the door for someone you don't know, or you're talking to, you know, someone who's 80 years old, and they seem to have lived a very sheltered life, you know, you're very cautious about, okay, how are you today? Blah, blah, blah. You know, it's like, it's not how you talk to your family. Character, you're much more raw. And the persona is extremely easy to change. Your character is very difficult to change because your character is sort of the gritty result of your life. You know, if you were smacked around as a kid, you have scars as a result of that process, and that is your character. And you can change it. You can definitely say, man, I'll never touch my kids. You know, I'll never behave this way. And so you don't. That's where a lot of us kids are different than our parents, because we didn't like various things that our parents did. And, you know, as a child, you're like, I will never do this to anyone else in my entire life. It doesn't have to be horrific things, right? My dad was always a guy that came home, and he's totally mellowed out now, but when he was younger, he struggled with the bad economy in the 80s, and he would come home, and he would have worked his ass off that day, and he would come home, and we wouldn't have any money. And I mean, like, imagine two guys, even though the cupboards were always full of food, we'd have like $50 for 2 weeks. And he would be pissed, and he wouldn't be the most entertaining guy to be with. And he was very very sensitive. So if anything else went wrong in the house, you know, an appliance broke or something, boy, he just would be so pissed. And I remember thinking to myself, I'm never going to do that. I'm going to be chill. You know, I'm going to try to laugh it off. Definitely not going to apply it to my own kids, right? Or my spouse. And I honestly say, very rarely have I ever done that in my entire lifetime, if ever. I'm not even sure I know how to do it. But then there's the third element of your character, and this was beautifully covered in the movie Forbidden Planet from 1956. If you haven't seen Leslie Nielsen's amazing sci-fi movie back in the day, which was the catalyst for Star Trek 10 years later, it's called the id. And as your inner core, inner child, we've talked about it several times on the show, but again, if we're going to talk about the state of mind, you're sort of, we're talking about the bits and pieces that build up your consciousness. And all of these things factor into your consciousness. It's just who you are as a human being, right? But your id is essentially a piece of you that is that internal child that, because it's so difficult to access that deep, deep layer of who you are, it's very difficult to change it, right? And what would be an attribute of the id? Well, I would say if you have fears that you're aware of, that would be, and fears that you're aware of that you're unable to just change. Some people are scared of spiders. Some people are scared of the dark. Some people are scared of much more advanced concepts. But you don't want to. And you look at the fear and you're like, man, this is totally irrational. This is totally stupid. Why would it be that a room is safe when the lights are on? And then when you turn the lights off, as an adult, perhaps you fear monsters. You know, really, maybe you fear ghosts. Maybe you fear that, you know, you've been watching too many forensics cop shows on television. And, you know, you just watched an episode where there's either aliens from an X-Files stuck in a closet, or there's some burglar or something just hiding in there. Go buy a gun. You'll be just fine. But you know that it is your state of mind, and you can almost utterly feel it. In fact, I'm going to say that one of the ways that you can utterly meet your id, and I don't know how many techniques I can give you besides this one. If you have the trigger that's going to make you fearful, and let's just say it's something as simple and beautiful as turning the lights off, then you're standing there looking at a bright room, and you turn it off, you turn the lights off, and immediately you feel the layers of protection that light is giving you, and it goes straight to some irrational, childish fear inside your chest. Now, I'm going to repeat a story, because it's been a season since I did, of where I absolutely, positively purged my fear of the dark. And it was the weirdest thing. It was actually a two-parter. My little hometown of Chanute, Kansas, we had a place called the Music Shop. I think it still exists. And he had a little shop downtown at the time on Main Street. And it was one of these, if you ever look at the brownstones, or, you know, like there's the brick buildings that build up those little towns in the Midwest. What those are, and I didn't realize it, is they go back like 150 feet to 200 feet. So if you have a storefront that's like 20, 30 feet wide, thing goes back forever. And this one is a double decker. It just so happened that the second floor was actually used as an apartment complex way back in the day in the 30s and 40s, if not even further back. And he was renting this place as his music shop, and he was only using the first floor. And so his thing was, he wanted to create some business, and he was a cool guy anyway. He turned it into a haunted house, and then he tapped a bunch of us in the town to build out, take one room up above. There's a bunch of rooms. It must have been like 20 rooms up there, and turned each one of the rooms into something scary. And so I got a room assigned to me, and I had goofed off a little too much. I had a really advanced idea of what to do, and the insurance company came in and said, you can't touch people. And that completely blew my idea. And so we created, I created the stupidest room on planet Earth. But I just basically built, I took a big carpet and threw it in there and then rolled it up. And so people walked over this horrible carpet. It was really stupid. And we greased up a wall with a bunch of Crisco, which got on people's clothing, pissed everyone off. It was horrible. Just a dumb idea. F plus for me. But I had procrastinated too long, and everyone else had gotten their rooms done, and I needed to get out there and get my room done. And I will tell you, part of the reason why I screwed off was that the guy that owned the place said he had a lot of confidence in me coming up with something creative. And he says, well, you'll probably win. And I took that comment from him, and I said, yeah, I'll probably win. You know, and again, I'd come up with a completely different idea where the walls were going to come in on you and there's going to be a slide projector and strobe lights and it was going to freak you out because the room's going to be shrinking while you're in there. But we weren't allowed to do that insurance-wise. But anyway, I had to go up and finish my room. So I go to the front door on Main Street with the lights on. It's wintertime. It's like October, right? And the door's locked. And I was like, oh, shit. I've got to get up there and get this done. There's only 2 days left. And I got friends volunteering to help me out, plus a girlfriend. So they're at the front, and I said, look, I will go in the back, climb up the fire escape, and then get to the front by walking through the entire thing. So I get up there on the fire escape. It's, man, talk about a crusty-ass rust bucket thing full of just tetanus. And I end up crawling up this thing, and the first fearful thing happened was that there was a huge wasp's nest right on the window in the back, big. But it was the day I realized that when wasps are really cold, they don't move much. So I had to open this door and walk around all these wasps. That was the first thing. But the second I get in this back thing, which is like 150 feet back at least, if not longer, I shut the door and it is pitch black. And I know in my mind, I've memorized all the rooms in my head, and the first thing I have to do is crawl through this big dragon's mouth. And it's pitch black. You cannot see your hand in front of your face. It's crazy. And so I have to crawl all the way through all the rooms, including my own, up to the front. And all the other rooms are finished. But it's taking me forever. And I have to memorize and touch and make sure I don't break everyone else's props. You know, like the dragon's teeth were props. I had to make sure I didn't break those. But I'm climbing through this thing, and it's a haunted house. And I finally got to the front, and it wasn't like my heart was pumping or I was terrified or anything, but this was the first time I'd ever confronted being in the dark in my life, like at that level. Got to the front, and I could look down this really steep staircase, which I don't know why staircases were always some crazy pitch back in the days, but they were. And I saw the light at the bottom of the door at the bottom where my friends were waiting outside. And so I go down and I let him in. It's cool. But after that day, every other time I've ever been in the dark paled in comparison to that day. You know, and there was no, you know, animals or anything weird in the dark, but it just got to the point where my state of mind couldn't hang on to fear because it took so long to get to the front of this place. It probably wasn't as long as it felt, but it just became a mechanical crawl from the back of this building to the front of the building. And so what was potentially emotional and irrational, it just faded away. There wasn't enough energy to do so. And I will tell you, and every single person listening over 20, I know that you for sure have had a situation where you were trying to hang on to your fear, your state of mind of fear, and you simply ran out of energy. Or it was over so quickly that you realized it was all pointless. It was pointless to have the fear in the first place, right? How many times have you seen kids be terrified of going to kindergarten in the morning for the first day? And then again, by the end of the day, you can't pry them out of the class. That's us half the time. Doesn't matter how old you are, right? But let's get back to controlling our state of mind before this thing's over. Let's just draw a line in the sand in our minds, and let's define two sides of that line. One, let's get very literal about this sand. Let's say that line in the sand is drawn in a desert which has no dunes. It's flat. As far as the eye can see, it's sand to the left and sand to the right of this line. And why is that important? Well, because either hemisphere is identical. The line in the sand is simply something that you have arbitrarily drawn yourself. You made a divide between left and right. A lot of times in life, that's exactly all it is. You've drawn an arbitrary line in the sand. And perhaps on one side of the sand, you said, well, I'm not confident on the right side, but on the left side, I'm confident. And that could be, and when I'm in public, I'm not confident, but when I'm at home, I'm totally confident. Well, that's a little odd, isn't it? Because the person who is you, you're the same amazing person when you're at home versus when you're in public. So why do you convince yourself that you're any different simply because you've walked on the other side of the line when it's exactly the same place, which you could say is reality, right? I want you to cut yourself a break if you're having that experience, right? Now, it doesn't mean that you can't do things to improve yourself and expand your appeal to the public. But you might, for instance, I know some people who are total geeks. And they sometimes don't make the conscious choice to change, but they'll go to, let's say, non-nerd conventions, and they find themselves a little incompatible conversation-wise with people. And then they go to a nerd convention and they're like, oh my God, I am totally compatible with everyone here. I can have great conversations about things and people care about things that I care about. And when I'm at this other place where people maybe are a little prettier, they're shallow and dumb and they don't think about anything that I think about. Everything's always ankle deep, right? Well, the number one thing we want to drive home with this state of mind consciousness thing is that you want to be in control of your state of mind. You. There's a lot of people who ask questions about whether or not we're in a simulation, a matrix, some sort of video game. And they get off on all this science that, you know, sort of quantifies energy packets and it starts looking very similar to the inside of a computer. But what's interesting is the conversation pretty much ends at the fascination of that anomaly. Are we in a matrix? But in the end, when I say, okay, it sounds like you do believe that we potentially are, maybe you're even more than 50%, maybe you're 51% thinking we're in a matrix of some sort. But when I ask them if they control their lives, one way or the other, well, no, you know, I've got fears, confidence level issues, all this kind of stuff. And I think, well, what's the point of believing you're in a matrix if you don't believe you're the player with the controls? When you play a video game, you completely control the character to the best of the game engine's ability to interpret controls from your thumbs, your fingertips, to control the character that's in there. So once you have figured out that a state of mind is something that we consciously have, the controls, the very next step that we can take, right? It's the potential step that we can take next. Can you walk forward? I don't know. Can you? Can you walk backwards? I don't know. Can you? Chances are, you're pretty free to do what you want. You could be a great person who tells the truth all the time, or you can be a liar that lies constantly. You could be a person that gives. You could be a person that takes. You could be a person that does one of those two things exclusively. Or you could be the person that walks right down the center. I'll share a secret that I'm not sure I've ever shared. It's not really a secret, but I decided pretty much in my 20s that the way I operate when it comes to taking goes like this. I made it a rule to give constantly in life. I mean, if I had a skill, I still do it to this day. If I have a skill and you need that skill, I give it to you if I can. It also helps if I think you deserve it. And there's very few people that I would use the word deserve with, but even if I don't think you officially deserve it, sometimes I just like to see what happens to your life if you do. You know? Let's see what happens when I give this random person something. And I'll tell you, 99 times out of 100, it's a beautiful thing, and I think most of you have experienced that. There's all these great videos on YouTube where people will, you know, give incredible amounts of money and time to homeless people. But they vetted the homeless people. They vetted them for their suffering, and they realized this person really wants to be out of the situation. there's that kid on, he's an Indian kid from India. He's actually from Canada. He's all Canadian American. His name's Rohat or something like that. He's a magician. And he's done some amazing experiments with helping people out. But what I decided in my 20s was, if I'm going to ask, it's going to be something fairly significant and big. And my friends are going to enjoy it. And they're going to enjoy it because I've been giving to them since I've met them. And I haven't asked for anything. And I know inside that they're good people. And that there's sort of a reservoir inside them that says, geez, I need to, I'd love to balance the playing field. I'd love to give back. And so my trend is to save up for something big and allow them to define their friendship with me through these more significant events. You know, it could be someone helping me move my furniture, which I haven't done in a long time. Or, you know, like on a rare case when I was younger, I would ask for like $100 just to make it to the next paycheck. You know, when I was really struggling at times. And in the end, they got to define their friendship with me as a result of those exchanges. And they know that I was right there, you know, with them to give them back the same thing that they gave and had given me, right? Now, I should have said a lot earlier in this episode that if you do enjoy your life, day to day, minute to minute, you really dig it, then I would say that your goal is simply to preserve the state of mind that you currently have. And don't let anyone screw with it. I should have said that earlier. And hopefully this has just been an affirmation of that belief system. But most of us have, you know, it's a little something-something that you want to improve. Again, the very first step is to realize what state of mind are you in that is holding you back from having what you want or what you need. And, you know, there's a lot of, I think, sort of subconscious guilt between the concept of want and need. As you get older, you definitely, well, I put it this way, when you are younger, there's the thing called entitlement. I have a whole entitlement episode I have not published yet. Hopefully it's good. But what is entitlement, right? Entitlement is best defined as you are trying to convince yourself that your wants are your needs and that you deserve it. All right. Then when you get older and you get a little more humble and you struggle, you realize, well, the one thing, if I can just take care of, life will be good, are my needs. And you will find, and I'm telling you right now, I've seen so much suffering since the 2008 crash, and now obviously we're rebounding beautifully here. And 2017 looks really bright for at least America. People have realized that their needs get met. You know, like I said, there's that somewhere in the Bible, there's a passage that said, you know, God feeds the birds and the fish. He takes care of all of the world. And we're so, you know, concerned about our needs as human beings. And once you have suffered a little bit, at least when you didn't have what you thought you needed, and it happens, right? Ask a homeless person. And then you get it. You get what you need again. And you get in a nice circle where you go to work, make a little bit of money, come home, and you're always able to put a roof over your head, clothes on your back, and food in your belly. And you find a reason to smile every once in a while. That could be enough once you've suffered, right? You start to realize, well, okay, the one thing I want to really secure with myself is my survival, my needs. And so your state of mind is always wrapped around sort of your bare strategic resources of what you need. But, you know, a year or two goes by and you really do master those needs. You know, you just sort of always have them and you take care of business. You don't cheat. You don't lie to get them. You have a nice system that society approves of and you approve of morally. Your closest friends and family approve of your techniques. And then you start to kind of, you know, dabble a little bit in the wants. Like, you know, I would like a new television. I would like a new car. And what's interesting is sometimes you can feel a little guilt for switching into the wants from the needs. Well, when you think about your day-to-day circle, your path in life, right, as it relates to state of mind, I think that you'll realize, if you haven't already, that the whole gamut of life as a human being is sort of this vacillation between needs and wants. It goes back and forth. When you start to feel like your wants are something that you deserve, maybe it works out for you. Maybe it develops a little bit of entitlement. Maybe your entitlement starts to get noticed by other people. Maybe they're a little annoyed by your thought process. So I want to bring that up to you because I want you to understand that those are probably some of the elements that feed in heavily to your state of mind. But why have a conversation about the state of mind? There's really just one answer to that. It just has to do with control, self-control. Now, there is control that we have inside our bodies, and there's control we have outside of our bodies that people witness. Obviously, the most important part is the part inside of ourselves. So one thing I want to leave you with very specifically, some of you will agree with and some of you will be bothered by what I'm about to say. As your closest friend, if I were such a thing, this is extremely important. And I'll give you two sides to the coin. It has to do with drugs, including alcohol. State of mind. Sometimes life is a pain in the ass, right? Sometimes it's painful. And sometimes we use substances to get around states of mind. I'm going to tell you, I have a whole episode on alcoholism. I've never known anyone to really beat drugs and alcohol, which is really the same thing, right? There's a huge, for me, it's just a push in an area that I think is very unfortunate, and I don't think it's actually as organic as people think. I had a listener really brief me on the strands of marijuana that the government has essentially infiltrated in the early 90s and restructured chemically. So a lot of the marijuana that you have in the United States of America is not just a organic strand that grew out of the ground and has not been touched. It's been so heavily messed with that it's actually got, you know, neural inhibitors in it. And it's been designed that way from the early 90s, which just happened to coincide with a lot of the, you know, gangster rap popularity of marijuana. Now, marijuana's been around forever. When I did it as a child, it was brown. But what do you, you know, if you're into marijuana, you're into the various, you know, sativa strands. And if you're super hardcore, you're into the chronic and just a bunch of stuff, right? I just described this to a friend of mine the other day. And, you know, I've seen this personally. I've experienced this personally. I got into marijuana a lot in my late 20s, probably about 27 to 30, somewhere in there. Just kept getting more and more and more to the point at 30. I was probably smoking two or three bowls a day, always at night, usually. Never mixed it with work, but I had a close friend of mine come up to me and say, you know, you don't seem that smart anymore. You don't seem that sharp anymore. And it was my trust of him that made me quit almost immediately cold turkey. Because I was like, well, he's known me since I was 18 years old, and I trust him. And he was right. I'm going to tell you that you got to be super careful with that stuff. Nobody wants to be preached to, but it's usually, if someone says, you know, don't preach to me about that kind of stuff, it's usually because they're very immature still. And it's all about, I mean, you can't tell me what to do. Dude, no one's trying to tell you what to do. That's not what's happening here. We're trying to put some cautions out there because I have to live with your ass as well. I have to stand in line in public with you. I have to ride airplanes with you and drive in traffic with you. I have to work with you. I have to sell products to you. I have to buy products from you. And if you're out of your mind on something, well, then you're not really a contributor to society. And here's how marijuana can really mess with you. And especially, again, I think that my friend was correct, because there definitely was a huge shift from the stuff that was smoked in the 70s when I was a kid, and 80s, and the stuff that started becoming the stuff in the late 80s and early 90s, which is the chronic, right? It messes with your short-term memory. Marijuana really makes it hard to have any short-term memories. It just does. As a young person, you're absolutely insane for smoking that stuff a lot, because this is when you should be as alert as possible and getting your life together. Your state of mind needs to be as crisp and as clean as it possibly can, because you know why? Because life will kick your fucking ass every single day that you're alive, and it doesn't fucking matter if you're a blonde-haired, blue-eyed guy like me with a great education and a great family and just happened to be born at the perfect time to take advantage of all the technology and art that ever existed. It will still hand you your ass every day of your life if you don't have your shit together. I can't even personally imagine smoking weed ever again. Ever again, right? I ain't trying to control you. I'm just telling you. It'll fuck you up. And if you think it's helping you, you're wrong. Whatever benefits you think you're getting from it, well, chances are you probably haven't engaged life that well. And I know people smoke the shit every single day. And I'm going to be offending some people that I've met and I know. But here's the thing. Imagine you smoked it every day for 10 years. You know what's going to happen? In 10 years, your long-term memories are going to be zilch. A fraction, and I mean a fraction of a percent of what they would have been had you not smoked. Why is that? Well, because your brain never had a control over itself. It wasn't able to form short-term memories, and if you don't have short-term memories, how the hell are you going to ever build long-term memories? And then how are you going to store intelligence? How are you going to store the connections of life? This causes that, causes this. This show's about you controlling your destiny, right? Through every lesson we could possibly share with each other, either in the comments or I might slip and say something really valuable, right? I'm going to tell you, don't buy into this, I am so cool, I smoke weed bullshit. You know, it's sort of like you determine how to dress by looking at a bunch of other people. You know, how many guys grew beards and handlebar mustaches? Because the guy next to them did it. At no point owning their own look, wearing clothing that just simply is the trend. You think life is forgiving about you grabbing the tail in front of you? Mm-mm. Nope. Your whole purpose on this planet is to do your own thing and to share that special thing that you've developed, good, bad, or ugly, with the rest of the world. Why do we revere people like David Bowie, Prince, you know, even George Michael? Because they were their own people, and they blasted trends into the universe, things that were really cool and not normal. Alcohol. Mm. Again, I have lived my life with some very talented, famous people. And for those who engaged in alcohol abuse, I can tell you they failed miserably in direct proportion to their amount of alcohol. I have friends of mine who are famous singers to this day, super famous people, and they lost their career for, in fact, one of my buddies is very adamant about this, and he said that he lost his entire career. He should have been famous in his 20s. He got famous in his late 30s, and when asked why it took him so long to get discovered, he said crack cocaine. He took a hit of crack cocaine at like 23 years old and didn't get his life back to like 39. And it's because he met a girl who said, look, you're amazing. Why are you doing this to yourself? Boom. Became amazingly successful, famous, and he doesn't really give a shit about the fame whatsoever, but he's doing what he loves and people love him for what he does. Sometimes we start drugs because something hits us super duper hard that is hard to deal with. That's, in my opinion, alcoholism is what starts when that happens. I haven't really known people to get into weed that much because of some traumatic thing. My friends who have, you know, who do weed every single day, they're into it as a habitual thing to be cool. And again, the people who think that you're cool because you do weed don't exist. They don't exist. it's all in your head. That somehow someone gives a shit that you smoke weed. Nobody fucking cares. And if they do, you got the wrong friends, people. Now, there's all this stuff, you know, on the web about, you know, cannabis curing things and stuff. Hey, that's a little bit different. Those are medicated versions of THC that don't get you high, right? It's there as a medicine. It's totally different. Totally different stuff. And if that stuff happens to work for you, then do it. That's a medicine. It's not there to alter your state of mind so you don't have to deal with life. Now, there's obviously tons of other drugs that I'm not going to get into. But there is one drug that I endorse as a huge augmenter of state of mind, but it's illegal. There's another one that supposedly has similar effects. I've never really taken any pure form, which is DMT. So I don't have anything to really say about that. But the one that's super illegal is LSD. I did a whole episode on season one. And I will tell you that it will connect dots for you for the rest of your life, provided that you're ready for it, which is not something you got to go watch that episode if you have any curiosity about it. It's not something you just take. And quite frankly, I think it's almost impossible to get pure versions of it. So I can't recommend you just take it at any point, because a lot of people will give you other things. So full disclosure, you know, I was able to get some extremely pure LSD a few years back, and it changed my life forever. I took it before I did this show, but that's a little bit different. And something, by the way, you don't do more than a few times your whole life. You don't need to, especially if you take it as an adult like I did. You really don't need to take it more than maybe once or twice, as long as you're lucid when you took it the first time, right? We all know that there are poisons out there constantly, poisons we can't control that fall out of the sky. There's poisons that are embedded in our food supplies. You can't be that pain in the ass that goes to the restaurant every day and goes, this is GMO, you know. But you know it's out there, and it will affect your ability to manage your mind, to control the electricity in your body. So my advice for you is to do the following. Wherever you can not pollute your body easily, do that so you don't pollute your body easily. And I'm going to tell you that drugs and alcohol are probably a couple areas where you want to really put on moderation. You know, you can get drunk, puke your brains out, and be okay, I'd say 48 to 72 hours later, right? The alcohol is sort of diluted out of your system, especially if you don't put any more in your body. But you can smoke, you know, a bowl of chronic today, and it'll be in your body for 30 days. I want you to think about that. And I know some people swear by it, but I'm going to tell you, you haven't met yourself yet. To the degree you've been on that stuff for years and years and years, you haven't met yourself. And believe me, I have friends of mine in Hollywood of all ages, all right, of all persuasions, and I watch them deteriorate over time. I watch them in professional meetings have a really hard time maintaining a linear thought. And they're completely unaware that they are suffering from their addiction. And I don't want that for any one of you. So here's the thing. You know, if you're sitting in the Midwest or something like I came from, drugs and alcohol, well, alcohol's very abundant in there, but it's usually like light beers and that kind of stuff, although they are getting into the more designer stuff in the Midwest now. But, you know, drugs like, you know, weed and various derivatives of, you know, cocaine and that kind of thing, it's a little less easy to get a hold of. It's a little harder to get a hold of, I should say. But what doesn't happen when you're in these smaller communities is you don't have a bunch of examples of how it screws up people. All right? But I have been in Southern California the second time here. I started here in the late 80s, early 90s, and then I left, went to the Silicon Valley where there was very little drugs other than weed. And then I've come down here since like 2003. This second run down here is where I've really dabbled in a lot of Hollywood and music, and in a combination of stories that I've heard about how people screwed up their lives, I've just seen it personally, right? And I don't know a single soul, all right? And I know dozens and dozens of people that drink every single day to the point where they say they constantly have the cold or the flu. That's their cover for being drunk as fuck and being completely intoxicated and hungover. And they try to use these excuses in professional engagements. Like they'll come to work the next day and they can barely hold their head up. But they're trying to say, oh, I got the cold. And you say, well, what did you do last night? I went to a party. My friends that smoke a lot of weed. Well, I have friends that are seemingly functional and friends that are completely fucked up. They struggle. They struggle way harder than they would if they would allow themselves to get into their own state of mind, the one that's natural to their body, the one that their genetics and their soul and their mind would create otherwise. You need to really detoxify people. Now, this cigar changes my state of mind. It does. And I've mentioned them a couple times. I think it mellows me out. I think it lets me see the timeline of my mind. But I will warn you, if you haven't smoked a cigar, I've never really smoked cigarettes since childhood. If you are in a, and this is my police to myself, my prohibition to myself. If I were to ever be the slightest bit sort of melancholy about my day, which rarely ever happens, but if I do find myself a little bit kind of off, you know, like I don't know what's bothering me, but something's bothering me, I don't smoke cigars. Or if I accidentally do, boy, do I ever regret it. Because the frequency that I have going into smoking a cigar is the frequency that will be augmented by the cigar. So these things aren't immune from my own judgment, just so that you know. But when I feel excited to do an episode and I'm on the patio and I'm just like, oh my gosh, so I got something interesting I think I want to talk about, it streamlines that to be very creative. But it also keeps my faculties very tight, as opposed to what happens to me personally when I smoke weed, which is I lose my mind. So I guess full disclosure on weed is that for me, it really racks me hard. And for a lot of other people, it doesn't seemingly rack them as hard. But I'm just going to tell you, I don't have friends that have ever escaped the demise of drugs and alcohol. None. And what's really sad is, you know, I'm not a really judgmental person, especially in anyone's face, right? I would never, I got friends that tell me they smoke every single day, and then I look at their lives and I go, wow, you really don't like the way your life really is, but you're smoking every day, telling me it's your survival medicine. And of course, you know, inside me, I'm going, well, that's cause and effect, man. But what happens is when you start hanging out with me personally and you see how aggressive I am with life, and you see my successes due to my aggression towards my goals and how much I sacrifice for my goals. The people that I'm around that do drink a lot, drinking is really the one that I'm around the most, unfortunately, because it's never been a legalization of it. You know, it's always been legal since we've been alive. They'll start to hide it. Because they sort of deep down inside know that that's probably what's causing them strife. It's interrupting their brain from being able to focus. It's a dependency. My friends who smoke weed, they almost constantly say that they can't remember anything, or they'll be going for names and they can't remember anything. The one I found that has happened with two different people, and they're probably watching, and I love them dearly, is they'll cut me off while we're talking. And they'll say, well, I have to cut you off because if I don't, I'm going to forget what I'm going to say. But then they'll smoke weed 3 or 4 times a day. And of course, I want them to have as much power as they possibly can with their mind, because I know that they're creative, amazing, beautiful people. And I'm eager to hear what they have to say. I would prefer we take turns. And I go, and then you go, and then I go, and then you go, and not me constantly having to remember what the hell I'm going to say because I got cut off 10 times trying to say one sentence, right? If you need help getting off drugs, I'm just going to tell you this. Remember two things. I've already said one of them. There's no one that exists on planet Earth that gives a shit how many beers you drink, how many cocktails you've drank, how many bowls of weed you smoked, how often you smoke. That person doesn't exist. And if they do, that's exactly the person you get out of your life. The second side of the game is, are you a tool? Are you a tool of your own life? Are you a tool of pop culture? Who told you to smoke that shit in the first place? Who told you to take the drink in the first place? A bunch of children, probably. If you're like me, I got pressured into drinking when I was young. I got pressured into doing weed when I was young. But in the end, after a few moments of getting sick, I mixed marijuana and alcohol when I was in my late teens and got super duper sick and realized you don't mix those two in my body. But I got to the point where I kind of said, I don't like losing control of myself because I got a lot of shit to do. I got a ton of shit to do, and it's really complex and it's really interesting, and people tend to enjoy the results of my fruit, right? So why would I want to rob myself of that exploratory experience? And why would I want to rob the world of that entertainment experience? And I know that being in Hollywood and being by music, that a lot of people will tell me that they wrote their best stuff high as hell. And that definitely happens. They'll write the best story. They'll get really creative on paper. And I've had a couple of those experiences myself. In the late 90s, I've got some artwork that I drew that was pretty interesting. But I tell you, for me personally, and this is probably not the case for other folks, it was very rare that that ever happened. But the thing I hear all the time is people that smoke a lot, they'll tell me that they get huge rushes of creativity by smoking. And then I go, okay, show me. Show me this gigantic volume of amazing things that you've done high. And what they soon realize within seconds is that they're full of shit. They're full of shit. They think that they've had all these creative experiences. And all they've had is a couple creative epiphanies in their mind that they were too high and too robbed of their short-term memory to be able to remember it the next day or to have the faculties to write it down during their cycle of smoking. When I first moved to California, one of my bosses, who was just a couple of years older than me, got into weed, smoked the shit out of it, just told me how amazing it was, and then he got married to one of the most beautiful girls at our company, and I mean beautiful through and through, physically, mentally, spiritually, and he ended up losing his mind to weed, and I caught him once at work, you know, crying and blubbering at his desk because he couldn't finish his computer homework, and everyone else in the office was laughing at him. He literally was sobbing, and I had to sit down and do his work for him so he could calm down. He eventually lost his whole life. He lost his wife. His car burned to the ground because he had a Fiero that had a mid-engine fire problem, and then he bought a brand new car and T-boned a woman coming home from work without any insurance, hurt her really bad and totally totaled his car and her car, fucked up his life completely. I guarantee he was high as a kite both times. No one likes to be told what to do, and no one likes to be told that what they love isn't good for them. If you are chronically strung out on chronic or drinking, I would say this. When's the last time you've had a clear state of mind? When's the last time you've experimented with your true inner brilliance? Because for my friends that have been strung out for 20, 30 years, if not more, it's been 20, 30, 40 years since they've had total control over their minds, right? And they all say the same thing, you know, I got to take the edge off. Got to take the edge off. Well, what happens when you deal with that edge? What happens when you deal with the hard things in life? Well, you typically get more resilient, more strong, more amazing. And then you start kicking life's ass one step at a time, right? It's like a funny walk from Monty Python. Every time you lift your heel and you put a foot forward, you're just stuffing it up the ass of life and you're taking total control of your life and nothing can stop you. And your state of mind is something you control like body armor on your body. You know, it's like it goes where I say to go and it protects me and it augments me. It makes me more amazing, and you make it stronger every single day. It gets thicker and lighter and more powerful. And you start to feel like you're the master of your own destiny. Your state of mind, it's your bitch. And that's what you want it to be, you know? There's very few people we would ever allow to reach into our brains and change our state of minds. There's a few people you could name. Like if you dug my confidence and you say, give me some of that confidence, you might trust me to reach into your brain and change a little bit of the confidence programming inside you. Okay, so there's like a little tiny example that might work for you. But the last thing you want to do is take an eyedropper of a chemical and just dump it in your brain, dump it in your bloodstream, dump it in your neural net and go, have at it, man. Do some shit, random shit to my brain, you know? Again, in the case of LSD, it's a little bit different. It starts to plug you into the entire universe and you start to see things you haven't seen, and it's like going to a museum. There's no short-term memory problems with taking an LSD trip if it's truly LSD. And that's why it's so illegal, because it'll reprogram mankind to love each other and get out of war. And, you know, if you took every terrorist in the world and you sat them down and you just gave them a huge-ass trip of LSD under the right mindset, they would never think about infidels again. They would never think about hurting another human being. They would celebrate the differences between men. I think that's about it. Sorry for the preaching, but it's just something that I think needs to be said. Someone has to have the balls to say it. Hopefully that was easy to digest. Apologize if it wasn't. Again, we're rebuilding society from the bottom up. We are taking control over this game called society. We are. One episode at a time, one comment at a time. I think we'll be better for it, right? Nobody knows the answers. We're all just sharing our opinions, and I'm just one dude with my opinion, right? If you dig the series, please subscribe. If you dig this episode, please like. Hopefully that last 30 minutes doesn't sour you too badly. The podcast feed is at mkultraradio.com. The site for the show is deepthoughtsradio.com. And that really just gets you to the feeds. So if you dig iTunes, you can get it to it from there. If you just want to use your podcast reader, just go to mkultraradio.com. Obviously, YouTube is YouTube. I'm also on vidme.com. Really a cool site. I think maybe it's vid.me, vid.me. It's the new YouTube. It's really super cool. And I've had some really cool experiences over there. They don't mess with all of your copyright stuff. They let the soundtracks roll and they understand you're not stealing the entire song simply because you're playing 15 seconds of it. So if you want to see season one's intros without any blocking on your devices, go to vidme, like it's vid.me. Anyway, I think that's all I got for you. Take care of yourself and someone else. Let's control our states of mind, and I'll see you in the next episode of Deep Thoughts. Over now.